This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Before Donald Trump took office, it was hard to find a tougher critic of him than Patrick Byrne, the outspoken libertarian CEO of the online retailer Overstock.com. He called Trump a disgrace to America and massively rebuked the reality TV star for comments about Mexican rapists and John McCain being captured during the Vietnam War. "I don't consider Donald Trump a businessman," Byrne told Reason in October 2016. "He inherited $300 million and ran it all the way up to zero, went bankrupt four times and shafted bondholders. He's a fake capitalist and fake businessman." But now Byrne has reconsidered his views on Donald Trump, who he says is dismantling the administrative state and deregulating the economy in powerful ways. Byrne is a guy who wrote a Stanford doctoral dissertation on the minimal government philosophy of Robert Nozick. He's a big Bitcoin evangelist. He's a pathbreaker and an innovator on online space. He's very libertarian. But he says that Trump is even right to challenge China on trade, and that libertarians need to be willing to confront places where the world is more complicated than our theories allow. He says that while there are still many things that bother him about the president, especially Trump's rhetorical style, it's time to realize that Trump is not only far better than Hillary Clinton would have been, but has moved things forward on issues such as tax reform, criminal justice reform, and school choice. Often mentioned as a potential presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, Byrne also tells me definitively that he will not be pursuing the 2020 nomination. Here is today's Reason Podcast with Patrick Byrne. Patrick Byrne, thanks for talking to Reason.
Always an honor, Nick.
You know, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about is you're talking about Donald Trump in different ways than you used to. What changed in 2016? You were pretty harsh on him.
I was harsh on him in part because I was also, I saw Hillary and I was absolutely gagging that we might have Hillary. And I think I might have just probably overdosed on anger at the whole system. No, obviously, I would imagine that most people listening would share stylistically. Yeah. I would not. Let's get past that. Well, what do you say about the style? What do you say about his?
Well, you had mentioned that. Even like in his initial announcement, talking about Mexicans as rapists and things like that, attacking John McCain for being captured in the Vietnam War. This kind of stuff.
That was awful. That was awful. Right. And that was awful when he did that. But how do you handle it? Since then, what has come out? So, for example, I thought his statement when he came down the steps that time about. Right. Mexico is sent us the rapists and this and that. And,
not even their best rapists, right? They weren't sending us their best.
So. Right. Okay. Yeah. But, since then, what's come out is a third of those girls in those trains get raped.
Yeah.
Now, are those from the other refugees? Are those from the people they're going past? I don't know. But some of his stuff doesn't, that's certainly not a nice. A polite way to put the point, and I might have put it differently, but as that issue has moved on and on, that seems a little more prescient. Well, much more,
Well, how about, talk about the large, kind of economic factors, because this is something, and there's no question that Trump's style puts off a lot of people, and it's designed to. It also rallies a certain number of people, right? Okay. Just because it's kind of coarse and vulgar, and it's also powerful. That's why he won the Republican nomination, because he said, to Jeb Bush to his face, "Your brother lied us into Iraq."
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I'm starting to see these things that I admire. Okay. Oh, my gosh. And I look at, I think I told you before, I thought his State of the Union speeches have been, people have always... Or many people, as all my life, have said, "Oh, if only we had a businessman running the company, country." And I didn't really put that much credence in that as a businessman. And I know how full of shit a lot of business people are. But he's better. Look at his State of the Unions; those are very businesslike. That every time I watch a State of the Union, I want to shoot myself in the head. When I watch a, frankly, Barack Obama State of the Union, and it's Nancy Pelosi. Jumping up like a little popinjay behind him every time he says, "We're going to pass a law that triples exports. We're going to pass a law that improves education," and then and people all applaud it. Trump's, if you look at his he's given very businesslike State of the Unions with real solutions.
Let's talk about some of the pro business moves he's made, because the economy is doing well.
Right,
there's the oddity of unemployment is super low, but workforce participation continues to decline. So it's kind of a weird situation. But we've had
better than typical growth under Trump. What are the key policies or actions you think he's either taken or championed that have helped the
Well, the first one situation? Is, you know, Obama had 500, Obama was always too busy to legislate. Mm-hmm. He did a whole bunch with his pen and his phone, as right. he said. Well, the problem with a president doing that is the next president right. can undo it. Well, the next president undid it. Yeah. And a whole bunch of it deals with labor relations, for mm-hmm. example, and has improved the game. I mean, they were on the point of turning the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, into like this apparatus. They were on the point of passing some really bad things under Obama, mm-hmm. for example, but and Trump got rid of that. So things like that have been very good for the environment. Also, you know, the Keynesian belief in the animal spirits is probably the least stupid thing mm-hmm. Keynes had to say. There is a psychological component to the economy, and I'd say that Trump has done an awful lot for the psychological component of America and given confidence and such. And that's probably has something to do with why we're having much better growth than people were thinking 3 years ago.
What do you think about, you know, the tax bill? And I'm sure given the tax way Overstock does, I mean, you know, changing the way that changing the rates of corporate taxes, but then also how it's collected on a territorial basis rather than a global basis. I mean, these are all good, but then do you worry at all about the fact that it's just increasing deficits? And
we're, I worry about that a lot. We're running $1 trillion deficits. We are going to be, I'm beginning to think that it might be this all is sort of a house of cards waiting, you know, everybody's hopes it's on someone else's shift when it collapses. But look at, for example, a really deeply embedded part of our tax code that was unfair was the deductibility of state taxes, mm-hmm. because that ends up just it reduces the incentive for local people to work out their arrangements in a tax efficient way, because they know they can have high taxes and it then gets them mm-hmm. basically a subsidy from low tax states. That was a horrific aspect. How many decades did that go back?
Yeah.
Reagan was talking about eliminating
that. I guess, yeah. And I'm trying to think, because there was something in the 80s when the tax laws were changed that affected that. But yeah, and we already see, and I mean, you live in Utah, which is a low tax state, but you see in California, we're talking in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, they're all seeing exoduses of right. high income individuals.
Right. I thought he caved a little bit. If you remember, he set the threshold at $10,000. I think the threshold should be zero. Right. I mean, however, so he's, you know, like any politician, he's made compromises.
And
such,
it's
but that was
that,
a tremendous improvement.
And that bill was not going to be passed without Trump being president.
Right.
You know, even though the Republicans have talked about this stuff forever. So, but then what happens when you look at stuff like, and you know, you're Overstock.com, you are importing and exporting, or I guess mostly importing
right.
goods. But what do you do about his trade policy?
Well, that's a tough one. In the following, I'm like that old Tom Lehrer joke, the proverbial Christian scientist with appendicitis. Because I don't know if you get letters from me saying that these days?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because every economist for the last 200 years has wanted free trade. Mm-hmm. But there's a national security aspect to our competition with China. Mm-hmm. And I worry about I think that maybe the libertarian model is not, mental model is not complete on free trade.
Hmm. Talk, well, how so? I mean, specifically about national defense. Do you worry that the Chinese government, you know, which does not necessarily own companies, but is either part owner or influences them, that they're embedding in technology and other things, spyware and stuff like that?
Well, things like, absolutely, yeah. things like that. But in a broader sense, and, you know, I have to say, I'm kind of shocked about this, but in a sense, how intellectual the Trump administration is. Take, for example, on this point with China and Michael Navarro, Michael Pillsbury, these guys who've been big intellectual. I can't think of the last time the foreign policy and sort of geopolitical strategy of the United States changed as it did in response to a book like Michael Pillsbury's book, which is this book, what is it called? The 100-Year Marathon. And the thesis of which is, in 1949, China set out on a 100-year plan to take down the United States. And basically, they're 70 years into mm-hmm. it, but they're running about 20 years ahead of plan. Mm. And that's the thesis of the book. And I got to say, it's a pretty compelling argument. And in Washington, there are two groups now, and someone said this to me at in a Council on Foreign Relations setting, but it was that there are two groups in Washington now, those who think that in 10 years, if we don't do something, we will be a vassal state to China. And the other are the people who think it's already too late. So now, how do you
actually buy that, though? I mean, because this, I mean, just kind of at the starting point of like, that sounds a lot like in the 80s when we were always like 3 years away from speaking Japanese and working for Sony or, you know, or Honda or something like that. And that didn't happen. But what is the, I mean, what would it mean to be a vassal state to China? Like, how is it?
Well, that they would be the global hegemon, that, you know, that equal to or stronger in power that we are now, setting the rules, taking Taiwan, eventually making their sphere of influence include Japan and South Korea and Thailand and Vietnam and such. And that would be bad, you know, since World War II, better or worse. So libertarians are all about peace. Great. But, you know, if you want peace, prepare for war. The United States is
Are you worried about Trump? I mean, most people criticize him and his administration for actually withdrawing from the world. So we pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was specifically designed to hem China in. We pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, which I think is a separate issue, pulled out of the Iran deal. We're kind of alienating a lot of our allies. So, is he doing two things here that are kind of at odds with? He is taking it to China, or says he is, in terms of tariffs, which I'm still in my libertarian phase. So it's I think tariffs are mostly
tariffs are horrible. Tariffs are horrible. Once Milton Friedman and I talked about this, and he said something like, "Well, why?" He said something funny like, "Why do you prefer? What is this irrational prejudice you have for a human being in the United States versus a human being in some other country?" Right. And part of it, the one answer is, in some deep sense, I don't. We're all humans. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, I'm an American. And third, I know how the world was before liberalism came along. And I think it has a real danger of descending back into that stage. And as far as I can tell, we're probably the best hope. Mm-hmm. So something that keeps our something that makes us a second-rate player and gives China the lead. You know, China has this social credit score, and they are now exporting that kind of stuff to Africa. They are teaching. I generally had hope, like Friedman, that over the decades, freedom would win and authoritarianism would crumble, and over the next 50-100 years, we'd be done with it. China's built the great technology of authoritarianism, and they're exporting it. And, they're getting it right in China. They're going to export it. So I don't want a world where they're the hegemon. I wish there were a world where there was no hegemon. I haven't figured out how to structure that yet. My friend of mine, Fuad Azami, wrote a beautiful essay once about how, you know, people who don't recognize the benefit that the U.S. has done for the world since World War II. Yeah, we've had all kinds of skirmish wars and stuff. But what the world was like at that, no one would have guessed in 1945 that we would have had, you know, even made it this far without another world war or nuclear war or something. And as we lose our power, it is not like in this case, another hegemon will rise and it will be costless or peaceful. What's going to happen if China is setting the global rules, you can sort of kiss goodbye the liberal world order that has been created since World War II. All of Africa will simply become, will simply be extraction states, no human rights. There'll be a technology that lets authoritarians stay in power, and no one will be able to defeat them.
So, are you optimistic that Trump's trade policy will actually hold China to account, or like force them to say, okay, we're not going, you know, we're going to accept limits on intellectual property, our ownership of intellectual property, exporting of certain types of technology?
Well, I think what it's going to do is get them to move to a new chapter in our trade relationship, which is this. We gave them terms to help lift. They were a basket case, and we gave them terms. And we basically decided to be, Napoleon said 200 years ago, something about China's a sleeping giant and woe mankind when we wake it up. Well, the U.S. decided in the early 70s to wake it up, that we were going to help transfer all this technology, do all these things. We gave it under Clinton, the terms you gave a basket case country in the 90s on how we trade with them, all kinds of preferential treatment. If all we do is get them to, and they have never given it up, they're now the second biggest economy in the world, they've never given it up. If all we do is we get them to say, you know what, let's go to symmetrical trade policy, that's all we need. So as a libertarian, how could you object to that?
Well, because it's even unilateral free trade is good for the U.S. But I mean, that's the basic argument. You know,
I told this story recently on Fox. And what a perfect example. Mm. I thought the same thing. And I had this is a terrible name dropping story, but okay. I had this wonderful period in my life where I could go back and forth with arguments between Milton Friedman and Warren Buffett.
Okay.
And I always took the position you just took on free trade. Well, especially, of course, after I
talked. So you
took
the Friedman position.
The Friedman position. And I would go back, and Buffett, who wants to put guardrails around trade, mm-hmm. he's got a very interesting idea. We'll talk about it. But he went back and forth, and I finally brought him that argument. And he said, Patrick, never forget that economists like Milton Friedman love to see the world in terms of lines that intersect and they smoothly readjust. But what really happens in the world is that I'll skip the Nebraska accent. These lines get hung up for psychological reasons or historical reasons, something. They get hung up. And then these enormous architectonic forces build up and build up and build up. And then, Patrick, someday somewhere somebody shoots an archduke and the lines snap and there's all this human misery and suffering. And that's really the answer. Buffett would say that if we practice what you're on paper, the economists would say, look, even if you're trading with somebody who doesn't practice fair trade, right. Your people get better off. Well, Buffett's point is that they get better off and they're hollowing out their future because we would be getting Nike shoes endlessly in return for little pieces of paper. Those little pieces of paper come back, eventually buy up enough productive assets that our children and grandchildren end up with a smaller share of future national income, and the foreigners who own to whom we're giving the pieces of paper for the Nikes now own a larger share. And so what we're really doing is ultimately we have found another way to benefit ourselves while imposing a cost on our future.
How has Trump's trade policies affected business at Overstock? Because, I mean, you're bringing in a lot of goods. Are any of those goods subject to higher tariffs and things like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were, about 5 or 6 years ago, we were 75% Chinese products. We're now down to 33% because we probably more than that. I mean, it's probably more than 6 years ago. We decided that we had to diversify our supply chain. Mm. I love Vietnam. I was a child of the Vietnam War, as you were, and I've just had this great affinity for Vietnam. So we're doing a lot and spreading out. It will, his tariffs will cost us, if there's no change, 2.6 million, we estimate, to the bottom line this year. Mm. And that's bad. That's bad. Something we will survive.
Part of the Trump rhetoric is that he's going to bring, industrial jobs back or manufacturing jobs back. Really, there's no way to do that because manufacturing jobs as a percentage of the economy have been declining since about 1943. It's mostly because of automation. And even when factories stick around, it's more robots and fewer workers. But what are does Overstock try to source more stuff within the U.S., or is that possible, or does that make sense?
Well, I would love to. In fact, I've been looking around for a mattress factory if I could buy or something, a cheap something like that. I would love to source more in the U.S. and find – however, it's really up to our consumers. And what we learned many times in the early days of the company, because I was kind of a buy American guy. I hate that. I know as a liberal, as a libertarian, we're supposed to be above all this, but I'm a real American guy.
All things being equal, why not buy American, right?
Yeah. Well, that was my attitude. Yeah. And so I started testing this and we had a buy American category. We had we had an American made designation on our site for any product that was American made. And you say all else being equal, you'd buy American. Okay. Well, what if they're not equal? But what if this jacket is $110, but if it's American made, it's $200. Would you still buy it more? Well, it was still buy American? No. But it's at some price you would. It turns out at a dollar, people don't care. People at a dollar, they'll buy the cheaper one. They don't give a shit about buying American. They'll tell you they do. You ask them in surveys, would you prefer American products? Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You put the identical products up on your site with $1 price difference and a Buy American on the one that's $1 more, 95% buy the one that's $1 cheaper.
What does, now that you're
migrating,
you're migrating to a post kind of libertarian mindset. I agree that there, you know, we're entering we're in a world where kind of libertarian truisms don't always add up to, you know, a complete picture of stuff. And I want to talk a little bit about the tech giants and possible regulation of them, because this is something that's coming and Trump is champion. But in terms of trade and things like that, can you find a mattress manufacturer in America where the product might be a little bit more, but to actually bring it to the customer, ultimately, all things included, the quality is as good and the price is competitive or cheaper?
Absolutely. That's what we're figuring out we can do. What I really want to do is find manufacturers in America, especially in the South, where there are a lot of clothing and textile manufacturers. Years ago, you know, when I used to work for Buffett 25 years ago, I was in apparel manufacturing, and here's a heartbreaking statistic. We had, in the early 80s, we had 3 million Americans manufacturing textiles. By the time I was doing it in the late 90s, there were 300,000, and I think today there's under 50,000. Right. That's a whole industry that shipped offshore, and it's now automated. Much of it can be automated. There's really the advantage of having that in a low cost, a low wage country is diminishing, and yet it won't shift back to us. So it's a very interesting
because even if you're sourcing more in America, it doesn't really mean you're going to be bringing in massive numbers of jobs, right, or creating jobs. And, you know, part of me, and again, this is, I feel like I'm channeling a medium for Milton Friedman, but it's like, well, you know what, like textile jobs, they were tough factory jobs. They were sweatshops. Maybe it's good, you know, that Americans aren't doing those jobs anymore, as long as the jobs that they're able to shift to when that goes away are better.
If they're doing other jobs instead, but if instead what they're doing is they're getting that clothing from people in Cambodia by just shipping them little pieces of paper, and those pieces of paper will come back in some other form someday and buy up farmland and buy up productive assets of the country, eventually we will be squatters on land that we have hoarded out to the world.
That's a Trump vision and a Buffett vision.
A very Buffett vision, actually. But people forget this. On trade, Buffett, the great capitalist, he's more Trump than Trump.
Yeah.
And it is, if you just look at it on the charts that you learn in college economics, comparative advantage and competitive advantage and all that, the world should be free trade. But when you look into the fact that we got a country with citizens that we're supposed to look out for, I don't want Xi Jinping or his heir to be
he's supposed to live forever and be in office as long as he lives.
Right.
There's no successor.
And his thoughts are equal to constitutional decree or something.
What about immigration? How does that factor into this? Because this is a place where Trump is extremely harsh. The rhetoric is extremely harsh. The policies, both in terms of trying to reduce the number, he's gone back and forth, reduce the total number of legal immigrants. He's talked about rounding up millions of illegals just last week. How does that sit with you? Yeah.
Well, the whole rounding up thing, I'm an American, which means I'm not getting anything that has to do with rounding up 11 million people is not something I want any part of. Yeah. And I don't like that. That's the kind of language that he's either has a tin ear or he's very subtle. And that, I don't know which that was. I guess, you know, you said immigration. I would have said, Nick, that's the first time I have heard you say something not completely thought through. What drives me crazy is the media doesn't distinguish between legal and illegal immigration. Set legal immigration aside, on the question of illegal immigration, there seem to be people who would say that the law should be that it's okay to illegally immigrate or something, that it's to turn a blind eye to it. And I'm a rule of law kind of guy, not in the sense of personal liberties and such, but I think the Westphalian model of nation states has worked out pretty well in life for liberalism. In fact, it's one of the things liberalism brought to the world. We don't want that to crater. And again, there's a national security, forgetting that even before you get to the national security aspect of illegal immigration, and it isn't the people from Mexico and Guatemala I worry about. Even before you get to that, I'm a rule of law kind of guy. Should do if some people don't have to, if the law is some people don't have to follow the law, I hope someone will tell me, because then I'm going to, my life's going to get a lot better
but
too.
But then would you favor thinking about, and you mentioned civil liberties and rule of law, but if you think about illegal immigration less as a moral issue of breaking the law to get here and more of a kind of prohibition problem of like when there is a market, a demonstrated market for something that a consenting adult wants to do and you try to ban it, you're going to get a black market. You're going to get a black market in people. So the answer would be to allow more legal immigration.
Well, absolutely. If you're in that, that's correct. That if you're on the side of, oh, we should be soft on illegal immigration, I would prefer you take the position of, well, then let's just be more open on legal immigration. But you got to have the fence. You got, you know, I'm from New Hampshire. Good fences make good neighbors. on the other hand, here's another Friedmanism. Friedman said that we have to choose between having open borders and having a social safety net. And as a libertarian, Milton said, would choose open borders. And that's in the context of the conversation where he said to me, why do you prefer the interests of somebody in America versus a human being? I'm not sure I'm right. Well, I'll put it this way. I'm not sure he was right or wrong or which I would choose. I might say, you know, I'm okay. I'm good enough with the social safety net. Let's keep it. And then you have to enforce the borders. But here's another way to analyze it. Whether or not you and I are good with the social safety net, the country has decided we're going to have a social safety net for, you know, since Roosevelt, we're going to have a social safety net. Given that we're going to have a social safety net, then the open border thing becomes a problem. It also becomes a problem.
You're not persuaded by analyses that show either in the first generation or within a couple of generations that even people who start as illegals end up contributing more than they take out of the system.
Within a generation or two?
Because
I'll have to see the analyses. Yeah,
because undocumented, you know,
I'm not sure this is a generation or two time frame we want to be thinking of. Go ahead and tell me that.
I was just going to say, you know, that one of the, when we talk about undocumented immigrants, as it's a more polite term than illegal, but very few immigrants are undocumented. They have fake documents. So they're paying Social Security, they're paying into fake accounts, they're paying income tax.
I'd like to see the analysis.
The three quarters pay basically all of their taxes and they really can't take any of that out. One of the reasons why Social Security isn't going broke faster is because of the money that's being pumped in by illegals who can't take it out.
Learn something new. Well, that's why I said I wanted to ask.
And this is actually, this is kind of a hop and a skip and a jump, but I know that you're interested in educational choice and Trump is actually pretty interesting on that topic. But the main outlay for illegal immigrants, when people talk about the money they're taking, it's actually if they're kids who may, if they're born here, they're American citizens, but it's their K-12 education, which is, you know, 15 grand a year or whatever. So it's, you know, illegals, they're kind of a scapegoat.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you'll have to send me some of your reasoned literature on that. I don't know about the $15,000 a year, whether you mean that's a lot or a little.
Oh, I'm just saying, you know, K-12 education
is $15,000 a year. So that's what they're taking.
Yeah,
that's a lot, it seems to me.
I mean, that was the result of a Supreme Court decision in the 80s that said public schools can't discriminate based on the legal status of parents.
Which I remember and which I, of course, agree with. Which I, of course, agree with if kids are...
But it does create this...
stress on the school system. Yeah, but that's interesting. That if, and I have heard that argument that they're paying in, but they don't get to legally take out. That's a good point. Well, if you're in favor of it, though, I think your next step should be, okay, let's have more legal immigration. So suppose I'd say then let's have more legal immigration and let's close the border.
Right.
You got to control the border. You know, the borders and nation states are very entwined with the whole liberal mission, liberal in our sense of liberal. It's very entwined in our liberal mission. And I think that we have to be careful about, you know, people who want to throw aside something that's been working 400 or 500 years without much, 400 years almost, without any evidence. I think they need to make a better argument.
So talk about education.
Before we get off that, well, how do you look at, for example, the illegal immigration from that's coming through the southern border that is, but from other areas of the world.
You mean like Guatemala and Honduras?
No, I mean like Congo or predominantly Muslim countries or Iran.
You know, it's so far nobody bad has come through there. No terrorists or anything like that. I mean, the
you don't
biggest.
Know that. How do you know that?
Well,
I'm sure you're wrong.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe. You know, and it could be by the end of the week. Well, you know, I'll be eating those words. But so far, so good. And again,
as the guy said when he jumped off the 100-story building, and he hit the.
I think that there's a confusion in kind of when people talk about open borders or more loose immigration. It's you still want checkpoints and you want everybody to come and present documents so that you can see if they are, you know, if they have a criminal record, they are who they say they are. And then the idea is that, you know, absent a criminal record or a communicable disease, my preference would be to let them live and work here legally. They don't necessarily get welfare. The school funding is a kind of tricky issue on that. And that solves the problem because it's not no borders. It's just that, you know, it's a kind of tips towards, yes, you can come here.
That's farther than I would go, but it does describe what I would do with the people who are here, once we get control of our borders, I think there ought to be some status created where they can live, that they're no longer these underground citizens afraid of the police. They're safe and they can pay their taxes. And maybe they have a road to citizenship. But to be honest, I would make the road to citizenship 2x the road for whoever came legally. Yeah. So if somebody who came legally 7 years, somebody who came illegally, okay, we get once we get control of the border, maybe we'll say, okay, everyone here, we'll give you a path to citizenship. Hmm. It's 14 years. And maybe more of it, I say as I smoke a joint, more of me resents my life is going to get a lot better if I don't have to follow the law in a way beyond things like smoking a joint. I could have a really fun life, but I don't because I feel this obligation and sense of duty. And I think that everybody should feel that way about – I've lived in places without laws. I've lived in Lebanon. I've spent a lot of my life in Lebanon and other places in the Middle East. And I know what people underrate – the value of having a properly functioned civil order and how quickly things – that's it. Lebanon showed me how quickly things degenerate if you don't even in a very sophisticated country like Lebanon, as rule of law becomes
– And is that the kind of the institutions of civil society? I mean, obviously the law, but also just the practices of people.
Right.
Everybody – it's like – if everybody's cheating, fuck it. I'm just, you know, doing whatever I want.
And as people were in Eastern Europe and in communist countries, I lived in China. China was different. China was but in Eastern Europe. Have you heard about these studies after the wall came down in the 90s? There were studies of honesty as measured sociologists and economists can measure in different ways in different games and in different, you know, you leave a $20, you know, tricks you play in train stations. And it turns out there was the countries that had been hardcore socialist, there was a radical decrease in honesty, even in things like, you know, Germany, and you had a beautiful A-B test, East versus West. So, that sort of, when you live in a place like that, which I'm sure you have, and where it's almost like we're living next, when you live next to a waterfall, you stop hearing the waterfall. In the United States, we have most of our life lived under a really good rule of law, profound, you know, world admired our rule of law. It's terrible. I mean, Transparency International rates us as falling, going from 18 to 22nd this year. Did you know that? We're now the 22nd most corrupt country on earth. Used to be the best, us in Sweden. But anyway, as that happens, I think people are going to learn that waterfall we lived next to and stopped hearing, the waterfall of rule of law, actually is something we really miss. Hmm.
So turn to a couple of policies that Trump is pursuing that seem pretty good or in line with, in a long term, your way, education.
School choice.
Yeah. So where are you on that? Prison reform. Also signaled that, you know, in terms of the war on drugs, his FDA has fast-tracked MDMA and psilocybin for treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of...
I would think that as a libertarian, you would have to... That's what I'm getting across. As a libertarian, we have to say, as much as, you know, the stylistic things have been occasionally a problem, that there's a lot of libertarianism.
There's a mixed bag for sure. And in a way, I do think that a lot
and good
of
instincts.
People,
he has libertarian instincts, it seems to me. When he gets into complicated situations, it's not so clear where what the reasoning, how he's reasoning his way through. But his instincts seem quite businesslike and libertarian to me.
And also statist in various ways, or cronyist, I think. But
well, give me crony. Give me an example of crony.
You know, like he's big on, you know, using the both the power of the presidency, but the power of the law to force certain deals through, or to say, you know, he's a big supporter of Foxconn in Wisconsin, which turned out to be a complete bust, or he, you know, jawboned, you know, Carrier into saying that we're going to keep air conditioning and refrigeration plants in Indiana. And of course, it doesn't work, you know, and it's like, you know, this is like, you don't want the president weighing in on every business deal.
Of course,
right?
you don't. That's like, the kind of stylistic difference. I mean, I think he's more, I don't think it's maybe as company specific as you just made it sound. He clearly wants there to be sort of blue collar industrial jobs, and he's gonna cheerlead anything that helps that and criticize anything and any departure. Agree. There's stylistic differences. You just want to take the guy. But on the other hand, you know, there's stylistic differences. It's made him appeal, of course, activate a group of America that's been that felt alienated from politics.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the tech giants. You do a lot, obviously. I mean, you have you're an online retailer. You have a really super developed and kind of baroque online presence and platform at Overstock. There are a lot of calls, and Trump is also involved in this, of saying, you know, maybe Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitter should be regulated as a public utility, you know, because they're not being fair to conservative voices. Do you worry about that kind of stuff?
Well, I worry about, I think that's handled in a best in a different way. They have an exception from the laws on libel because they are just an open platform. Right. I forget the name of that
bill. Well, it's Section 230. It's actually any online service provider or like website. So you have the same protection if in the comments section somebody at Overstock says, you know what, this person is a complete piece of garbage, blah, 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 and libels them. You as the owner of the website are not responsible for the libel that the user generated.
Yeah, but don't they – I thought they have an additional – protection from libel, not just regarding the comments section.
Not really. I mean, if it's content that generates from the company itself. So if Mark Zuckerberg libels somebody on Facebook, Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are liable. But if somebody using Facebook libels somebody.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, then I see that. But the issue then, I understand, but the issue then isn't that about the comments section. I'm talking about the if the Washington Post published an article on their website that libeled somebody, they'd be liable.
Right.
What Facebook is doing may look through its algorithms, and frankly, what Google is doing has the characteristics of taking a position, even though they're only manipulating the comments and links of other sites. It's in some sense, it's taking a position, and frankly, in a rather sneaky and not necessarily pernicious, but a way that's not as obvious as if you're just reading the comment section. So they're really taking a point of view like a newspaper is the argument when they do that. Or are they more, when they're manipulating the links, so you can't find any evidence about, if you want to look up global warming hoax, there was a period on Google. If you Googled that, you got all kinds of links about why the global warming, people who think global warming is a hoax are crazy. And when you're doing that, you're taking a position. And it's not just like...
But you don't think it's a private company that gets to do it?
Well, if they're taking a position, then fine, they should be able to do it. But then that goes back to questioning, to taking into question, should they really be treated like the comment section in a newspaper, or they should be treated like the publisher?
Law, under the Communications Decency Act.
So, but when
maybe the law then needs to change.
Yeah, but the law is... But my point is, the law is like that because it is thought that they are being neutral like the comment section of a newspaper. But suppose that if they're doing this with algorithms and really, by the way, I know people in both of these companies, and I don't want to say too much, but they've done scientific testing and they know exactly how much they can sway public opinion by this.
To go back to China,
and there was some of that in both directions in the last in the last election, both directions. Believe it or not, there was a scientific test conducted that was done, I'm told, as just a test because they thought it wouldn't matter, but something that actually helped one of the candidates that they deeply regret now. They did it because they didn't. They were just testing because they did. They thought they had the room to test, and they actually, there are people in one of those companies who think that they made Trump president because they did this test.
Well, he did phenomenally well on Facebook. He did much better than Hillary in terms of engagement and reach of his articles because more, you know, I mean, I obviously all of this, one of the great veneers of the internet is that it's not a perfectly flat system. There's a lot of tweaking going on in the background so that you see more of this rather than that. But he won Facebook. You know, more people wanted to read about him and talk back through his statements and things like that. So it's, and it, you know, clearly we would assume Facebook employees were not pro-Trump, but the technology ended up being.
But don't assume that. What happened Facebook employees are not pro-Trump, but it is possible that somebody played with some dials just because they thought they could.
The
bigger answer to your question is my instincts are you let technology solve it. You don't have government. For example, there's a great website called Minds.com. Mm-hmm. That is like the libertarian answer to these. Do you know Minds by any chance?
No.
I Oversock is an investor.
Okay.
But it is a website.
M-O-N-S?
Minds. Minds.
Minds. Would be a different type.
M-I-N-D-S.
Yeah. Okay, great.
I have like, how would you say that word? Sorry.
Minds.
Minds.
Minds, yeah. Okay. But no, you were pronouncing it correctly. I'm sorry. I misheard.
M-I-N-D-S. And it's one of the, you know, there are these sites out there that try to compete with Facebook by offering different. Well, it's a combination of Facebook and YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's a social media site, but it is radically libertarian in terms of its free speech policies. So, I don't know if anyone can challenge it, but for people getting tired of the, for people who do want to check out of the mainstream system, there are alternatives spring up. And I would in general prefer that as a solution to regulation. However, I do think that it has to be questioned if Google and Facebook are manipulating their algorithms as much as seems to be the case on some issues. Should they get the same liability protection as the comment section of a newspaper, or should they be treated more like the newspaper, which does have libel risk?
Right. Although it doesn't say anything about fairness. I mean, because this is the big side of the Trump stuff is also that Diamond and Silk, the black women from North Carolina who are Trump fans, are not getting a big enough reach, and that's because they're being screwed over. And it's like, really, even if Facebook is screwing them over, that Facebook gets to do that, right? As a private company.
As a private company. However, what happens if, for example, Google makes it so that anyone who searches for libertarianism or reason is shown links about the delusions of libertarians and delusions of anyone who believes in liberalism and freedom and all that kind of stuff. And it just becomes impossible. Suppose they did it radically and made it really hard for people like us to find each other in society and snuffed out our point of view. What would your attitude?
I would want the market to address that. And I do have I suspect it might be a naive belief that if Facebook, if Google, if Twitter actually got as bad at all of this as many of the detractors say they already are, people would start vacating these platforms. And there's some sign of that. Facebook use, Twitter use is flattening or declining slightly in North America.
What happens? Okay. So suppose they don't do it radically. Suppose they're just doing it subtly. Yeah. Great. They can do that. But then aren't they like a newspaper? Are they really like a comment section?
No, but then the shift kind of registers a little bit. Then it's the question is, are they like a broadcast TV station, which before the 80s had to employ the fairness doctrine? It had to supposedly represent all points of view equally, which of course it could never do. And online service providers, online web content providers are, by law from the 80s or from the 90s are exempt from that. That's what Section 230 is about. So if we want to go down that road, which I think would be disastrous, I mean, Congress really has to change the law. So
either that is a solution or my preference and my hope is that the tech solutions emerge.
Yeah. Well, and also that the platforms just become more open. I mean, it disturbs me You know, I never have read or encountered anything by Alex Jones or Louis Farrakhan online, but it bothers me that Facebook bounced both of them.
It bothers me immensely. That kind of, that stuff they're doing and this use of hate speech, the concept of hate speech, which is silly, is not a, it's like saying, it's, I feel like we're living in the 50s, or I grew up in the 60s, but I grew up hearing these stories of this awful intellectual environment where people could just say, oh, that's communist or something, and everybody shivered. Well, it feels to me we've reached that an equivalent environment where, you know, where people talk about shutting down hate speech, and the stuff that is getting censored, I find some of it, frankly, to be quite respectable intellectually. Mm-hmm. Jordan Peterson is getting censored. I find that crazy and demonetized, and all kinds of people for, it's interesting. It's, you know, comedy used to be what we used to find what were the edge of social mores are. It seems to be Facebook now, and we have people who are very subtly exploring, okay, well, can you say this and not that? Can you say, and it turns out to be very interesting what you can say and not say. And there are, but when you compare, you know, the hateful things that get said by some elements of society, which never get banned and which are totally fine, but even things that through that have to, that one has to really somehow twist oneself to interpret as hateful, coming from other groups of society, are now censored.
You know, Trump, of course, is also, you know, he's running in the context of, or any Republican of, you know, it's Republicans and Democrats for the most part. Are there any of the Democratic contenders for presidency that you, for the presidency that you find interesting or actually attractive?
Well, step number one, do they believe that we should pack the Supreme Court to 15 people? A whole bunch of them have signed off on that. Anyone who signed off on that, I'm not interested in. Who else is left? You tell me. Is there anyone left?
I think Biden, you know, I don't think he's signed on to the court packing plan.
But okay, we'll see above that thing about rule of law.
Yeah.
That's above. Anyone who signs on to packing the court, I'm not interested in.
Yeah. So.
I find it shocking that we're living in a country where this is being... I was in...
People talk about Trump destroys norms. This is one of the charges that's lobbed against him all the time. He's destroying all these norms. But then you have... You know, virtually all of the Democratic presidential candidates said we're going to pack the Supreme Court, and we're going to get rid of the filibuster. We're going to do this, that, and the other thing, and like take down institutions that have been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and plus the accusation that Trump destroys norms, while true, is also an argument that control freaks are put forward, because some of the norms that are destroyed are norms that we never really agreed to, and they're norms that got socialized into us. You know, a lot of that is just sort of pearl clutching to me. I think about 2/3 of what I hear about Trump is pearl clutching. I mean, and a third bothers me. Mm-hmm. I mean, of these accusations, but about 2/3 are just little pearl clutching. I think of, look at NATO. Now, forget what, so what's the agreement on NATO? We were all supposed to spend 2.0 or 2.5%. Was one or the other?
It's a little bit unclear, and these are targets.
But there was a target established. Right. It was an explicit target, and let's say it was 2.5% in the early days, or I think 2.0%. That was the target, the soft handshake, gentlemen's agreement, say. Well, you know, Italy and Germany were down to 1.2%, and we're spending close to 4%, 4.2%, I think, at one point. That, you know, and so Trump comes out and says, okay, why is that fair? And the press goes nuts. He's questioning NATO. Doesn't he know what an ignoramus? He doesn't know how important NATO has been. And then it's all a bunch of look at the birdie, look at the birdie. It's a very reasonable thing to say. We all agreed to spend 2.0%. Right. You're spending 1.2. I'm spending 4. Hey, we got to get back on track. What's wrong with that? And so that's a norm. I mean, people would say he's destabilizing a norm, but I'm okay with it. It's like these, to me, it's why I couldn't, I had great friends in academia, and I have to mention Stanford. Whenever I criticize academia, I have to always mention Stanford was fantastic to me.
And this is, you have a PhD in philosophy from Stanford.
Correct.
Where you wrote about Robert Nozick's.
And John Rawls.
And John Rawls. Theory of Justice, yeah.
And I also, I mean, I had, yeah. But I was also at Cambridge and Dartmouth and stuff. I had great times in academia. But I was there I was in Cambridge, England, when the first time somebody used the expression politically correct with me, and she used it people forget, you know, it isn't, Alex Jones didn't come up with this politically correct. Politically correct, it was actually a Stalinist term. The Chinese have a term, 政治改革, it means political correction. Nick, you've been a running dog imperialist. Right. We're going to send you to Weed Peas for 10 mm-hmm. years for political correction.
Right.
You'll be politically correct.
Yeah, and political correctness as a term, it emerged from the left, where people were disciplining each other within to make sure they were politically on
track. I was at a dinner party at Cambridge in 1989, and this woman was describing to me someone else and saying, oh, he's one of us. He's politically correct. Hmm. And I had to say, and it was such an ugly sentiment. I couldn't even understand. They had to, so it came from the left. So some of his breaking of norms has really enlarged the scope of what we are allowed to think about, mm-hmm. I would say. Just like, you know, people criticize or the gay pride parades in the 90s, the people who defended it rightly said, look, by being this outré, this shocking and this and that, it does break the norm so deeply, it makes people rethink, and then mm-hmm. it creates this whole new sphere for us to live in. And they were right about that. Well, Trump is doing that. Now, some of the norms, here's my big thing on Trump. I don't think he's racist. I wish he would make more, and I think he's done wonderful things for Black America. I think that he's should make more of a point and maybe should give some civil rights speech. Why doesn't he lay out a point of view about his point of view on civil rights and, mm-hmm. and the future civil rights in America, for example? He should do more to now, all that said, I love it. 35% of Black males support him, and something in the high teens on female. It's very, he's had the highest Blacks.
Well, that'll be interesting. I mean, he got, it was under 10% of the Black vote. He did do better with Blacks than Mitt Romney or John McCain, and he also did better with Hispanics, which is kind of fascinating.
But since then, look at what's happened since then.
I mean, this is, we'll see.
Male, Black, so forget, I'm not on voting, but just percentage of Black males who say they support him is up into the mid-30s. And that's, the truth is, that has something to do with the thing on illegal immigration. It is, absolutely the case that unskilled immigration brings competitive pressure against our lower paid or less skilled workforce.
I don't think we have time to challenge that. I'll send along
what
in the packet of material.
In Houston,
because there's a substitution effect, and that basically the jobs that low-wage, unskilled laborers come here to take are not the ones that Americans are either doing, or they move into a higher level service.
I was with Susan Sarandon a few months or a year ago. That
this is quite a name drop.
Oh, this is a name drop.
This is like the best name drop podcast.
This is name drop. Susan and I are friends. You're going to be shocked at this. Susan and I are great friends. Yeah. And actually, and she's friends of friends. So we're, and she was complaining to me, I guess about a year ago, something about, oh yeah, but I heard in Houston, just the food in the field is now, you know, it's the wages have gone up to $22 for someone to go out there and pick because Trump's enforcing. Well, what's wrong with that? Maybe there are people who want to, in Houston, who want to go out and make $22, and we'll find out. You think that doesn't happen?
Typically what happens is that automation comes in. That's what happened in California. That's what happened after they stopped the Bracero program in Texas in the 50s. So it's a mixed bag. But and also then once the wages go up, more illegals come because they're like, oh, look, I can make $22 an hour. It gets tricky very quickly. And there have been, in recent memory, there have been times, and, you know, and it's 20 years ago, the Democrats were super anti-illegal immigration in 1996. You know, Bill Clinton spent a good chunk of his nominating speech.
So was the NAACP.
Yeah.
Go back in the 70s, and, the NAACP
but,
was
you know,
all
when you
it.
Choke off a supply of farm workers, like a lot of crops, you know, just rot.
I mean, well, things will adjust. Things will adjust. I look forward to reading your links and being educated on this next time.
Final question. In the past, you've talked openly about possibly running for the Libertarian Party nomination for president. Where are you thinking about that, and where's your thinking on the LP? In 2016, you were a big Gary Johnson, Bill Weld supporter. Where are you at now?
I haven't been following it too closely. Mm-hmm. I would say I find it unlikely I would run in 2020. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to tell you, because I think that the best someone could do would be a spoiler that would tip things into the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I want is someone who wants to put pack the Supreme Court. Right. And also, there's other things going on in my life. So I'm not going to run this time. Who else? I hear Bill Weld is running again. Is that?
But he's running as a Republican against Trump. Actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For a primary challenge. So he had been courting the Libertarian Party quite openly, and then announced as a Republican. So he's trying to kind of work a little bit of voodoo that way. What do you have a prediction? Do you think Trump will win re-election?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah.
And why?
Minuteness of the Democrats so far. They just seem, I got to say this. I grew up trying to be very even handed about them, but they're just seeming silly to me. They're seeming silly. People fighting this, scrambling over each other to go farther and farther left, talking about, you're now campaigning on destroying the rule of law, on destroying the Supreme Court. That's crazy. Whereas the other, you know, where Trump at least campaigns on, let's get Federalist Society judges into, on that issue alone, how, you know, what's your feeling about that?
I think that's a great question to ask, particularly of libertarians, because they often talk about the judiciary as very important, and Trump has been pretty good on that. I happen to be, because my background is literary studies and I know nothing about the law, I tend to discount the actual judges that get put into place, possibly too much.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. But, you know, he's made at least, Neil Gorsuch seems to be great so far, and I'm sure he'll have a couple more picks, so. Well, we are going to leave it there. We've been talking to Patrick Byrne. He's the CEO of Overstock.com. This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Patrick, thanks for talking to us.
Nick, thanks. I look forward to reading your links and and being more educated on the immigration stuff and coming back to you next time.
Well, we'll see. And please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Google, at Apple, at iTunes, at Reason.com. Thanks for listening.